Well, I really appreciate you coming on and talking about your latest research. It's astonishing. Every week, you know, we find out more and more as we dig more deeply into the story itself, the public discourse, and also what you're doing in the laboratory. It's so amazing. I just wanted to ask you generally, you know, just to start off, have you seen anything as bizarre as this?
No, I mean, this is completely extraordinary. So I've been the GP for almost 30 years, and I've done routine coughs and colds and pneumonias and heart attacks and diabetes, and I've worked hard to do the best by my patients and to find the best therapies and things like that. And it was really a big shift in the middle of last year to realise that the information that we were getting from our regulators was completely inaccurate. And so I was having conversations with my pregnant patients, which would go along the lines of, you know, I've spent 30 years trying not to have my thalidomide moment. We encourage women not to drink, not to smoke, not to have Valium. We change their antidepressant medication. We change the asthma inhalers. If they get a urinary tract infection, we give them an antibiotic that's been used for the last 50 years to make sure that there's no potential harm for the fetus. And then suddenly it's safe to give a completely experimental injection. You know, it doesn't make sense. And when I've had these conversations, I always end up with the other person agreeing that it doesn't make sense. And then I say, let's walk over here. On the other side, we've got the Royal GP College, the College of Obstetricians, all the midwives, the Australian Medical Association, the mainstream media, Norman Swan, who's the spokesperson for the ABC, all saying it's safe and effective. I say it's white, they say it's black. That for me was where things collided. And if that's not safe and effective, then it's not safe and effective if you plan to have children in the future. It's not safe and effective if you're prone to autoimmune conditions. It's not safe and effective if you've got a background of cardiovascular disease. It just goes on and on. And the information has just got worse. And now we're looking at excess deaths in Australia, running at around 16% or something. You know, the birth rate plummeted from 20-odd thousand births a month to less than 7,000 births in one of the months recently. It's just unbelievable.
Can you talk a little bit about what sort of led you from the practice of medicine? What led you from the practice of medicine to more of the research that you're doing right now? What were the things that started transpiring in your practice that you began to think something doesn't seem right here, and you began to maybe pursue unanswered questions?
It actually didn't happen like that. It was I could see that things were gravely wrong. We were forcing people to have an injection for which they weren't giving consent. We couldn't possibly give consent because we weren't being told what was in the injections. And we were being told not to look. There's nothing to see here. So I immediately decided that was the first place to look. So in June last year, I bought a dark field microscope so I could have a look at what was going on in the blood and, you know, what was going on in the vaccine. And I was aware of some of the reports from around the world about abnormalities being seen both in the blood and the vaccine, and I wanted to have a look for myself. That was the motivation. It was just this strong feeling that this obviously wasn't right, and the need there. Look, we were being told by the same people not to.
So it was pretty much just the shift away from routine practices of medicine to something quite unusual and bizarre that raised your suspicions to really look more deeply into this. I'm sorry, you were going to say something.
Well, I was going to say that in February, I had a patient from Wuhan just turn up at the practice, and his family were in hospital with suspected COVID-like symptoms, and he wanted a swab, and we hadn't done any up until that point. So I'd seen the photos, and I'd been keeping myself abreast of things as best I could. So I was as scared of what was going on as everybody else and what the implications for that could be. And, you know, I did my 9 hours of TGA training on the vaccine, and having a speech disability and a neurological problem and potentially being in a vulnerable group and also being a frontline person, I did my training on the AstraZeneca vaccine. And I had 2 doses of that before I realized that the 9 hours of training that I'd received was propaganda, and that really there were some major issues when I realized that the TGA received 94% of its funding from this pharmaceutical company. I thought, oh, mate, we're in a lot of trouble here.
When you say TGA, can you explain?
All right, so that's the Therapeutic Goods Association, I assume, TGA, which is my understanding was it was an arm-length non-governmental organisation that reviewed pharmaceuticals and determined that they were safe for the public. And I knew that they were taking a hard line on the evidence base with regard to vitamins and supplements and alternative medication, which only works if they're independent. And they can't be independent if they're receiving, you know, any degree of funding, let alone more than 90% of funding. I mean, that's just complete capture, obviously. And we've spent the last 18 months writing letters saying, this is not right. This is not right. What's going to happen here? Can we have more information about this? And by and large, the answer has been nothing.
For those who would say that the research you're conducting is a waste of time, is useless, could you sort of walk us through the steps we can take as concerned citizens? What can we see from the work that you're doing, that you're seeing right now, so that we can better understand what is appearing to you as a professional?
Right. I think that's useful to look at that in terms of the blood and in terms of the vaccines. In terms of blood, I think people are aware that there are problems with people dying suddenly from heart attacks and strokes and an increase in neurological problems. And I would encourage anybody who's been vaccinated, particularly with the mRNA vaccinations, to seek a review of their metabolic bloods and their liver function, their kidney function, and also to request what's called a D-dimer test, which can indicate the presence of microblood clots. And if that's significantly raised, it can put them at increased risk of a heart attack and stroke. So that's something that people can do in terms of their own situation. And one of my focuses is going to be on how we screen the population, how we identify those at greatest risk from having an event as a consequence of the injections. As far as I keep calling them vaccinations because that's what we all know them as, but in terms of most of the looking I've done has been at the Pfizer vaccination, and that's because I've had access to more samples. And certainly it's been the predominant vaccine in Australia. So it's when you, I'm happy to show some slides at some point, but when you look, just straight look at the Pfizer vaccine under a microscope, under relatively modest magnification, 40 or 100 times magnification, it's quite apparent that, you know, there was something strange going on in terms of the appearance in the vaccine.
I see the backdrop you have behind you here is and it looks like an interesting sort of something from you might see from a lava lamp in the 1970s, but it's not that at all, is it? It's something that you recently discovered.
Yes. So I've got a short number of slides, and it's probably useful to go through them. So this is typical of the appearance of what we see when we just look at a liquid sample of the Pfizer vaccine under the microscope. And there's two things to note here. There's all the sparkly stuff in the background. That's not normal for any sort of vaccination or even any sort of medication. And then quite commonly we see these floating structures within the liquid. And this has been reported by people all over the world. And nobody knows what these are, what their purpose is. And every time people have asked, sort of, for please explain, we're inevitably told that it's just cholesterol or it's just natural and there's nothing to be concerned about.
I see some geometric structures, polygons or...
Yes, it's sort of rectangular structures and polygons and amalgamate and circles and combinations of those sort of shapes. Yeah, it's hard to reconcile those sort of shapes as something natural. So when the drop dries out, and this is what got me sort of interested in this, I left my slide on the microscope overnight, mainly because I forgot I was going to throw it out. But the next morning, it had all these crystals in the periphery. And I'll show some more closer up of these shortly. But, you know, I was told that these were just naturally occurring crystals as a result of the salts in the vaccine. But I persisted in trying different things to see how interesting, like, sort of structures I could come up with. What I found is that eventually the crystal structures actually turn into these chip-type structures. And this is an example of one of the chip-like structures that I've come across recently, and this is another one.
Can you give us an approximation of the size of something like this?
Right, okay, good question. So this is currently at 100 times magnification, or it may even be 200 times magnification. It's in that sort of ballpark, and a red blood cell would be about that sort of size, I would think.
So is it on the micron level or the nano level?
Yeah, it's microscopic. It's certainly not nano. It's relatively large. Yeah, so it's in the order of 60 microns. It's in the order of microns, not anything smaller.
Is there anything that we can tell from the apparent illumination that we're seeing?
That's a good question. When I first started looking at these, I thought the light was light that was coming through a crystal-type structure from behind. But with further looking at it with a different type of... This type of appearance is what we get when we use dark field microscopy. which concentrates the light under the sample into a cone. It causes quite a lot of diffraction, which gives you a lot of contrast. We can look at these with the more standard optical bright field approach, and it gives us quite a different appearance, and that can be quite interesting in terms of determining what's going on. The blueness of the light is actually a refractive thing, and it's due to the way the camera works. You can actually get rid of that by reducing the saturation. So that's actually not relevant. So, you know, certainly I've got photos of hundreds of these objects. But with the type of microscopy that I've been doing, it's not possible to determine what the elements are or what analyze the actual materials involved. And that's just a view above that, this ribbon-like structure. This ribbon structure is quite important because this is the same size and the same appearance as the structures that we're seeing in the blood. My colleagues have actually observed these structures actually being formed from the matrix that we see in the background. So these structures aren't there to begin with. They actually self-assemble from this matrix.
And do you have some images that you can share that show the self-assembly or the apparent self-assembly?
Yeah, this is compilation video, and it's showing the image behind me being constructed. So this is 200 times magnification, so it's micro level, it's not nano level. And it's sped up approximately 400 times. So it's happening very small and very slowly. There's quite a lot happening. I've got this playing the same way a couple of times so that you can sort of take it in. And then I've got focusing in on the different areas.
As I'm watching it, it reminds me of a kind of synthetic life form. It doesn't seem to occur in nature, but some other form of, maybe a form of synthetic life that I've never seen before. How many hours did it take for you to capture this video?
I think it was more than 7 hours. I think it was closer to 12 hours. I'd have to double check. It was certainly it, was certainly more than 6 hours. I can't be 100% sure. One of the engineers from Yanovitz, who's in our group, who has looked at this video, has made the comment that this cloud is potentially lipid nanoparticles, and lipid nanoparticles can obviously contain a payload which potentially could be used in the construction of this structure. I hadn't noticed the movement of this light previously. I've only watched it a few hundred times.
So because this is not an electron microscope, is it possible, is it reasonable to say that the lipid nanoparticles come into view to the eye at this level of microscopy when they come together or they carry out their function in self-assembly? They become visible. Does that seem reasonable?
That seems reasonable. It's obviously beyond my area of expertise, but that's basically what Shimon was suggesting, was that this is potentially a cloud of thousands or millions of lipid nanoparticles that have been stirred up or have been activated. So this is the picture of the structure 2 days later. And, you know, it's changed enormous amount. So I actually condensed the video for those 2 days, and this is what we saw. There were lights that were coming on and off. And indeed, there were lights coming on and off, you know, for about 12 days. And this moves and this light comes on then. Then what I've done here is I've superimposed a bright field image on top. And we can actually see that under this bright light, there's this black donut structure. Under this light, there's this dark material as well. So it's not a light that's coming through from behind. It appears to be a light that is coming from this black donut. So I then started looking for these donuts amongst my other structures. So that was an example of the previous one, was an example of a construction sequence. As well as that, I've got about 6 or 7 examples of a deconstruction sequence. And this one is probably the easiest one to get your head around. So this occurred over 3 hours. And while you're in real time, nothing seems to be happening. And then all of a sudden you realize that things have changed dramatically.
It's amazing.
I'm still not quite unsure what we've witnessed there. But just rewind it a little bit. What is that process that we're looking at? There seems to be a very solid structure, and then all of a sudden it just melts away to nothing, and it doesn't come back. This structure obviously disappears at the same time. But over the last week, I've sort of been paying a lot of attention to these black blobs, which seem to be an integral part of this construction and deconstruction process. And during this process, they actually change themselves. They actually become far more spherical and they tighten up in size. And during this week, I've been putting some of the vaccine sample in a magnetic, in a strong magnetic field. And the same thing has happened. The blobs have changed into this type of smaller spherical structure.
So you're saying that when you expose this material to electromagnetic radiation, that it seems to react.
Great. We knew it reacted to wireless routers. He's been able to grow and shrink crystals with a degree of EMF exposure. But I hadn't used a magnet and I wasn't aware of, you know, magnetism producing a result. But I mean, magnetism can produce a field as well, obviously. So that's provided some interesting pictures for me this week. So this is an audio visual that I put together, which has got a number of examples of the deconstruction sequence. And this was my attempt to try and get my head around what I've just witnessed. So I'm quite happy to play this for your audience, or we can, you've seen this one, Daniel.
Yes, that would be great.
Okay. I haven't watched that for a couple of weeks.
It is astonishing, truly. Sorts of words can we draw upon to describe what we're now witnessing? I'm at a loss. I'm at a loss for words, really.
Yeah. So I just keep looking for stuff. Because that's the only way I can sort of keep going with it.
What do you make of all this talk of magnetism and Bluetooth connectivity? I've written about this a little bit last year in a Cyborgs paper, just kind of following up, trying to connect some dots in the scholarly literature in biotech and material science and in governments where they, you know, people in positions of authority talk about the bio-nano age, quote unquote. This is going back to 2001. So there's a There's at least two decades of research and development in this area. Now we have people, scholars like Yuval Harari, historian, who's talking about surveillance going under the skin and you know, nanomaterials and so forth, and human beings being hackable creatures. And now we're seeing stories about people who have been injected exhibiting signs of Bluetooth connectivity. So there seems to be lots of circumstantial evidence to make a strong case that what we're seeing is something very insidious and something that is surreptitious that's happening in these quote-unquote medical interventions. So what do you make of all this, given what you are seeing in your own studies and then this huge background of, you know, scholarly inquiry and the development of these materials?
Well, the first thing to say is it seems crazy to ignore it and to say, it's obviously got nothing to do with what those people are talking about. They would seem to be quite crazy. So while I was bending forward before, I don't mean to distract people, but I was just getting hold of this wee magnet. And wee magnets are a pain to have around because they just tend to fly all over the place and stick to things. But I actually popped this on my vein in my elbow about an hour ago. And I'm actually magnetic at my elbow. This is actually attracted to my vein. Now, I've looked at the blood. I've taken a venous sample. I've got quite a lot of structures in my blood. So I'm not overly surprised that there is something there that could be attractive to a magnet. But that was the first time I tried it. So that's sobering, you know. So I think we all need to start thinking about these things. The other thing that happened to me in the last 24 hours was about a week ago I downloaded a Bluetooth scanner app for my phone, basically wanting to have a look at the whole MAC address thing and the Bluetooth situation that you've just discussed. This morning in my office, I found 72 recognized MAC addresses, and 12 of them were either within 20 centimetres of my phone, or they were very strong signals, less than 70 dB, or, you know, minus 70, which is recognised to be excellent strength, according to Wikipedia. I mean, I had to look that up. And then, so I'd had a discussion with Matt Taylor, engineer, about the situation, and we systematically wrote down the addresses that were of high intensity to check that they were unrecognized. And I eliminated all the vaccine samples and slides and things that I had in my office, and I put the ones I could inside a Faraday bag, and I took them to the other end of the house. And then for the rest of the day, I just took some baseline data about what the number of MAC addresses that I could detect without having those other ones available. And sure enough, the next time I checked, I had no high signal addresses and none that were within 20 centimetres of my phone. That had all gone. So I bought them all back and nothing happened for about an hour. And then I had two high signal close addresses within 20 centimetres that lasted half an hour, and then they disappeared. So the question is, the chips that I have witnessed with lights coming on and off, and they appear to be intelligently constructed and of intelligent design and consistent with people who are saying they're going to do these sort of things, and consistent with people that have got recordable Bluetooth MAC addresses, are the chips producing those MAC addresses? That's the question. And that's something I'm keen to try and work out over the next little while, and involving my colleagues to have some rigor around doing that.
Are you registering as a Bluetooth device?
Personally?
Yes.
Not that I could tell. But I've got I've got quite a lot of noise. I'm not sure. One of the 32 could be me, but I don't think so. But I'm not sure. Initially, that's what I assumed when I had 12 that were within 20 centimeters. I assumed some were inside me. I was quite pleased to get that down to zero.
Last question. Can you believe we're actually having this conversation?
Just... on the Saturday night. No, it's... it's completely bonkers.
Yeah.
But when the evidence is in front of us, you know, so I just thought I'd have a wee look, have a little look. Not believe the narrative when I was presented with evidence that suggested the opposite. I was fortunate to do stage one psychology at university in the Stanford experiments and Tash Bell's minimal discrimination experiments and all that sort of stuff. And you know, I was aware that you could have a group of people and everybody apart from one sees the light as green and one person sees it as blue, and over time that one person will be convinced to say the light is green. So I was certainly prepared to stick to my guns, you know, and call it as I saw it. And that's got me in a little bit of hot water. But I keep finding things. I keep looking and I keep finding things. So I'm going to keep going as long as things are there to find.
It's a good way to live. Always seeking the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Nixon, for the conversation.
You're most welcome, Daniel. I look forward to doing it again in a couple of weeks when you hopefully got the Bluetooth thing